Hello, everyone, and welcome to Blogging Theology. Today, I'm delighted to talk to Hassan Spiker. You're most welcome, sir.
Oh, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
And you're actually in England, aren't you? You're not in California at the moment, so.
I did manage to crawl my way back here, yeah. But the sun seems to be forgetting to come up here. Not sure why.
It's quite different from California. For those who don't know, Hassan is a philosopher and comparative scholar of Islamic, Greek, and modern thought. He's the son of Anglo-American converts to Islam, members of a trailblazing group who in their 1970s communes initiated some of the first experiments in the revival of traditional structures of Islamic knowledge and Sufism within the desacralized context of the modern world. After growing up in a rich spiritual and intellectual home environment, Hassan spent 12 years studying the Islamic sciences in the Middle East. In the course of his studies, Hassan principally focused on interactions between the school of Ibn Arabi and late Kalam theology, and also completed his memorization of the Quran. Upon his return to the United Kingdom, Hassan entered the University of Cambridge, which I think was recently ranked one of the top three universities in the world by the Times Literary Supplement, I seem to remember. Yeah. By the by. Where, for his MPhil, he studied the works of Plotinus, Kant, and Hegel under the guidance of Professor Douglas Headley, a renowned scholar of Platonism and German idealism, and one of the key contemporary proponents of Platonism as a living tradition. Fascinating. For his thesis on the relationship between Platonic hierarchy and Enlightenment conceptions of individual self-determination, Hassan received a distinction and faculty prize from the University of Cambridge. Congratulations on that.
Thank you.
From 2014 to 2022, he was a researcher on the Taba Foundation's flagship Classification of the Sciences project, widely lauded as one of the most significant contemporary attempts to renew the epistemological and metaphysical foundations of traditional Islamic philosophical thought. Now, his main area of study in Islamic thought is the intersection of Ilm al-Kalam, that's Muslim theology, Avicennan philosophy, and experiential metaphysics. In Greek thought, his main area of study is the Neoplatonic critique of Aristotelian immanentism. And in modern thought, it's the philosophy of Kant, the metaphysics of freedom, and the possibility of metaphysics. And Hassan joined Zaytuna College in California as a lecturer in philosophy and logic this year in 2022. Today, Hassan has kindly agreed to discuss his new book entitled Things As They Are, Nafs al-Amar and the Metaphysical Foundations of Objective Truth, a work which we might describe as an introduction to Islamic ontology. So, over to you, sir.
Thank you so much, Paul, and it really is a great pleasure to be here. So, here is my first slide where I have the title of my book, but with a question mark, Things As They Really Are. Mm-hmm. And this is a question of the possibility of objective truth, not so much particularly in the context of Islamic philosophy, but in the context of the particular intellectual impasse, as I like to call it, of our situation post-modernity. Mm. And so just to launch into that, modern thought is at an impasse because of the legacy of Kant. Descartes' attempted solution to the failure of Aristotelian immanentism affected the Cartesian split. Now, I appreciate these are going to need significant discussion. And
there he is.
Kant's attempt to reconcile rationalism and empiricism resulted in his separation of being and knowing.
It was Kant, a young Kant.
Today, an arbitrarist voluntarism glorifying the self-determination of the individual reigns supreme. And here we have
Who is that? So I don't know that person.
That's Judith Butler.
Ah.
Who lives near us in Berkeley. And I consider her to be as probably the most important theorist of gender fluidity. Really at the very, very cutting edge of the spirit of the age when it comes to this arbitrarist voluntarism.
Well, what are their pronouns? I should ask this, shouldn't I? Is it the right question? Is it she, or he, or?
Oh, their pronouns. I'm not sure. It could be Xi. Yeah, I'm not sure. I'd have to check that.
I was just a passing question. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I should have really researched that. But anyway, they are a famous LGBTQ plus gender fluidity theorist in Berkeley at the moment, really at the very cutting edge of that. So did you want to say something, Paul?
No, it's just good to thank you for introducing this person. I'm loath to say he or she because I don't want to transgress, but it's good to see a face to these ideas. We've seen, obviously, Descartes and Kant, and now we've got someone who's very much alive in California today at the cutting edge of the zeitgeist. So it's good to see who these people actually are.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I think that if you were to single out one figure today, it would be her. Really leading the way there. So what I'm hoping to do today is hopelessly ambitious as it tends to be, but one of the things that I'm hoping to do is just to show how we've arrived at the state that we're in intellectually today. And of course, doing that's going to presuppose being able to depict in a reasonable way what and be able to agree upon what our condition is. And I think it is very, very distinctively part of the legacy of Kant. Let me try to depict the situation that we're finding in terms of the dominant intellectual and social trends of today, let's say in terms of gender fluidism, simply as one of the manifestations. But this is what I describe as an arbitrarist voluntarism. For the benefit of any of the viewers, voluntarism, of course, is the idea that the will has ultimate priority. So the will, whether it's the divine will or an individual human being's will, and of course, it has numerous different permutations and manifestations in terms of different theological questions. So you have, voluntarism in terms of divine command theory, which is the idea that the good is only what God happens to will. It's not, there's no intrinsic good and so on. And there are many different manifestations. There's, of course, Schopenhauerian voluntarism, the idea that the most fundamental ontological reality is simply the will and individual wills participating.
What was his great book called? It has the will in it, isn't it? Schopenhauer. I forget the name of the book.
It does. It's something as will, and that's about as good as I can do. I can't really remember.
His most famous book, anyway, has the word will in it.
I have it here
in my library. Hang on. Before we both go off and look in our libraries for this, let's move on. I don't want to distract you.
Yeah. Sorry. I wish that had appeared in my mind at the right moment. In any case, Schopenhauer's... but it's no accident that someone like Schopenhauer, who's very much a follower of Kant, would end up coming to that conclusion that the will is more primary than anything else in existence.
The world is will. It just suddenly occurred to me, the world is will.
Exactly.
The world as will and representation.
Yeah. Absolutely, that's it. The world is will and representation.
Yeah.
That's it. So, but what I mean by voluntarism here is the idea that what the individual wants, the manner in which the individual of today wishes to determine not only the course of their own lives without outside interference, which is kind of what we mean by freedom, that word which is endlessly bandied around and usually not defined very carefully, but what is so distinctive about our age, in the hands of people like Judith Butler, is it's moved beyond simply human actions. The idea that we should be able to have full possession of our own individual wills without outward interference in order to determine the course of our own lives, but it's come that now it embraces what previously were considered to be essences, the way the world really is.
Yes.
And so, you know, whereas the first targets when it came to Marxism and Marx and Engels and their immediate followers were key human institutions like the family and so on, and of course various forms of aristocratic political arrangements long before that, divine command theory and everything. Today, it's why has it? I mean, the reason that it has got to a point where it's attracting widespread attention far beyond the realm of what was traditionally the preserve of professional philosophers. I mean, it's constantly under discussion in the pages of the Telegraph and the Spectator and the New Statesman and the Guardian. Of course, they're more or less taking opposite views, is because it's now embracing things like human nature, things like gender, things that seemed previously to be non-negotiable because they were
fixed. They were determined by nature, by our DNA. But now they're, as you say, fluid. That they're not settled. They are. Well, I'll let you explain what they are, but they don't have that essential quality anymore.
No, thank you, and that's precisely it. And the thing is that this widespread belief tends to permeate everything. So, I mean, if we just take the traditional Platonic transcendentals of truth, beauty, and goodness, the idea now is that there is no real truth. There's no objective truth. There's only my truth. There's no real goodness. It's just what you and I agree we feel is good in the particular context, and it's made good in some sense by our agreement and by our both willing it. Yeah. And in beauty, there are no fixed intrinsic aesthetic standards, but it's all, you know, it would be experienced a kind of perverse oppression for someone to impose their own aesthetic standards on someone else. But it's not only these various types of aesthetic and moral valuation, but it's also things which previously just were thought to be simply part of the order of nature, like being a human being, like being of a specific gender, and so on. And the interesting thing is that this has trickled down to the ordinary, I mean, I hate to say this expression, do forgive me, but the ordinary man and woman in the street, because, I mean, it's got to the point where this will typically be voiced, and even some of the simple rationale or argumentation will be voiced by the average person in the street, as it were, in the so-called West today. So it's not just the preserve of, you know, strange philosophers in the ivory towers, but it really has trickled down. And that's what's so interesting about it. But the point is, this has a very clear intellectual pedigree. And, you know, the blame, I suppose, if we want to call it blame, or the praise, depending on how you look at it, should be really laid at the door of this man, Immanuel Kant.
That's very harsh. That's a very harsh judgment, sir. Very harsh.
You think so? I'm sorry about that.
No, Immanuel Kant. I mean, we're not actually. You've not actually mentioned who Immanuel Kant is. Perhaps we should just. Shall I introduce who he is, or do you want to say briefly?
Please. If you'd. You'd help me out there, yeah.
Okay. Well, he was a philosopher. He was born in Konigsberg, which was then part of Prussia. And it's changed hands a few times.
In now 17- part of Russia, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Russia, but it's actually German originally, in 1724. And he's seen as probably the greatest philosopher in modern, greatest Western philosopher, I should say, in modern times. You know, we've had Plato, Aristotle, and Socrates in the ancient Greek world 2,500 years ago. But the greatest thinker ever since then is this guy called Immanuel Kant. And there are many amusing stories about him, how he never, ever left his city or his birth. He was a creature of habit, and the townsfolk in his city could almost set their watches by the time, the same time every day he went out for his constitutional walk.
Oh, he's a very exciting man, yeah.
Yeah, but he was, despite that image of a dry and dusty figure, he was apparently extremely popular and
be fair.
Dinner parties, and you know, he was a great raconteur and wit. But the book that he's famous, I think, for having produced two editions of this great tome. Let me just get it up here. Ooh, here we go. Oh, and your copy as well. Yeah. There we go. We both have the same copy, which is a bit sad. But this is the standard modern edition in English, edited and translated by Paul Geyer and Alan Wood. So if you study this at university, as I think we both did, this is the edition you will use. It's a big fat text. I call it the CPR, the Critique of Pure Reason, because you'll need CPR if you attempt to read this. In other words, you'll need first aid, because it is the most difficult book to read imaginable. It's crusted with jargon. He invents new words, neologisms, just to articulate his architectural architectural philosophy. But anyway, I'm not going to go into who, but this is a man who has had a huge influence on Western thought, Western philosophy, and all philosophy since then arguably has been in dialogue with him, either to reject him like Hegel did perhaps, or to embrace him like Schopenhauer did perhaps. But no one's indifferent to him. And I must say, he's one of the most extraordinary thinkers in philosophy I've ever come across. If you appreciate his synthetic a priori's and his, you know, it is quite revolutionary, and truly a Copernican revolution, as he called it, in epistemology, and to some extent in ontology as well. But I'm resisting temptation to go into it, so I will shut up now. That is Kant. Oh, by the way, I will say one more thing. If you want a really good introduction to Kant, a beginner's level, for me, a really readable intro is by the guy called Roger Scruton. Who's a philosopher, died just a couple of years ago. He actually had a wonderful dialogue with Sheikh Hamza Yusuf at Zaytuna College. You can watch it on YouTube. Roger Scruton was a professor in many places. But anyway, he wrote this brilliant book on Kant, very readable, very short, a very short introduction, published by Oxford University Press. It's a standard intro to all of his thought, not just the Critique of Pure Reason, but to his ethics, his view on religion, his view on reason, his place in Enlightenment thought, and so on. So I recommend that as an introduction. I do not recommend this book unless you have done a lot of other reading first.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Anyway, enough of that.
Thank you very much. I was really enjoying that. But if you insist on handing back to me, then I suppose. Yes, so I mean, my basic contention, and I'm by no means alone in this, is that, and it's approaching something like consensus in certain circles, is that the impasse that modern thought is widely held to be at, because we can't get beyond this kind of fluidism about the world, which causes all sorts of problems, which we'll go into, no doubt. But this is ascribable in a meaningful way to the legacy of Kant. But there is a very significant figure on the way. There are, of course, many, and this is obviously an almost embarrassingly simplified version of history. But nonetheless, just because something's simplified doesn't mean that it isn't true. It just means that it has to be simplified in order to, for one thing, fit into a couple of hours of a presentation. So there are obviously hundreds of years that have passed in all of this, and thousands of significant thinkers. But one of the figures who is undoubtedly pivotal on the way to Kant is Descartes and his famous Cartesian split, which is ascribed to him. And what that basically comes down to is the idea that instead of there being a single integral whole world, which is intrinsically intelligible in the sense of knowable, the world is imbued with spiritual essences, metaphysical essences, what Aristotle would call form, what the Platonists would call capital F form, and they'd see the world of becoming, this world, as merely a kind of shadow of that world of real being, the world of the forms. But nonetheless, they both agree insofar as the world is intrinsically intelligible. There really is something called human nature. There really is something called nature writ large. There really is something called a tree or an animal or whatever it happens to be. The various categories of being are real categories, and they really do represent essences which are distinct in themselves. And it's not merely individual substances like the ones I've mentioned, but it's also moral valuation, moral and ethical valuations, aesthetic valuations also to a large degree are actually embedded in intrinsic nature of things. And so Descartes is part and parcel, one of the key thinkers in the move to a very different view of the universe and the cosmos and being, which is often summed up as belonging to the so-called scientific revolution. And one of his key contributions is this mathematization, well, I managed to get that out, mathematization of the physical world. Yes. That the physical world is no longer a world of spiritual essences, and very key, it's no longer a world of purposes. There are no purposes in nature that we can know objectively. It's simply a mechanical world of extended substances. All we can really know about bodies for Descartes are that they're extended something. And as such, they're amenable to mathematical investigation. Descartes is also very important, and he's alongside numerous other figures of the same period, in that he has this really important distinction between primary and secondary qualities. And primary qualities, I mean, viewers who aren't familiar with this distinction, there's an awful lot on this, but basically primary qualities are qualities in nature which are amenable to some sort of quantitative appraisal. So number, figure, solidity, in a way, what is meaningful for Kant is that everything that can be studied about a body in the physical world is summed up in just the fact that it's an extended thing. So for him, that's the physical world. It's mathematics. There's mathematics in everything, and that's really, in some significant sense, all it is. And so the split in question is the fact that there's no connection between subjective individual experience, which is famously summed up for Descartes in terms of I think, therefore I am, in terms of the famous cogito, and the physical world outside. And so the way that we're going to map out our subjectivity is going to be fundamentally different to our investigation of nature. And the difficulty with Descartes is he could not see any way to reconcile the two. And this is why we talk about the Cartesian split. It's this bifurcation of reality. Our subjective experience and what we can know from that, starting from the fact that we can't doubt that we exist, and so we can know certain other truths that follow on from that, and that's what Descartes considers to be his reformed metaphysics. that is a completely different sphere of investigation to the investigation of the material world. They're just simply have a total difference in kind with no overlap. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the traditional scholastic understanding, I won't call it Aristotelian because it wasn't merely Aristotelian, but we'll get onto that. But in the traditional scholastic understanding of what we might call the High Middle Ages, there is a complete continuity between nature, the physical world, as we call it today, and our capacity to know it. Because nature in itself is imbued with intrinsic intelligibility in the sense of objective knowability. Our minds are also imbued with this intrinsic ability to know the nature, the natures of things.
Right.
And there are many different understandings of how this works. So for someone like Plato, the reason that the world, that somehow, you know, the world as it is in itself and our attempts to know the world do actually result in successful and real knowledge is because both of them are caused by the forms, not only the world, the physical world in its instantiation, its manifestation, its creation is caused by the forms, but also our structures of representation. In his case, you know, the innate ideas which allow us to recognize things in the world are also effects with an E of the forms. And then in the Aristotelian context, you have, you know, a rather more tortured and difficult journey because Aristotle has about 5 lines on the agent intellect in Dynamis, as you know. And the agent intellect is what many different schools of thought within Aristotelianism, whether it's Avicenna or Aquinas or Averroes or whoever, justify the claim that the way things really are and our knowledge match, i.e. that we have real knowledge. They justify that claim because they say there's something called the agent intellect which underlies both of them. And is allowing that agreement to happen.
Is this known as the correspondence theory of truth in epistemology? Is that or?
Absolutely. I mean, this is very much related to the correspondence theory. This is one of the most important kind of mechanisms within the correspondence theory of truth, which is, right, when we look at, and we're, in fact, thank you for mentioning that because we're just about to get there. But when we look at the world and we ask how it is that we know it, or if we think that we do know the world, how do we justify the claim that we have objective knowledge of the world rather than just the idea that it's some sort of subjective imposition onto the world? The standard and original way to justify this, and really the only way until Kant, and interestingly, Norman Kemp Smith, one of Kant's most important contemporary commentators, said Kant was the real origin of the coherence theory of truth, which is the most fundamental competitor to the correspondence. But let's go back to that. The correspondence theory is basically my mental representation, or if you want to put it another way, my propositions about the world, we actually get round to constructing propositions. My propositions about the world are made true by corresponding to the way the world really is outside my mind. So you have, on the one hand, propositions about the world, which are not extramental, they're mental because they're propositions. And you have the way that the world really is extramentally, as in outside the mind.
It's objective, it's independent of our mind, and we can know things in themselves. This is
absolutely.
I'm looking a bit to Kant here, but we can know things in themselves objectively and truly, and they correspond to ideas in our mind, and so there's this correspondence between them. Yeah,
absolutely. And so, you know, that becomes very easy when we're just talking about, I mean, look, here's my proposition in my mind, which is, I'm having a proposition here. Kant's Critique of Pure Reason is blue and it's in my hands. And then look, corresponds to reality. Yeah. Yeah. So that's the correspondence theory in action. Now, that's all very well and nice, if you're a logical positivist or someone who doesn't believe in anything beyond the sensible world, because it's very neat and tidy way of looking at things. You've got, you know, lots of physical objects, and you have propositions about them. And then how do you know those propositions are true? Well, do they refer to this extra mental state of affairs, you know, two books and so on. Now, where does the problem come in? And the thing is, this problem is, I would argue, the most important problem in, I'm afraid, what I consider the deterioration of Western thought to the state of affairs we were discussing just now, championed by thinkers like Judith Butler. This is the most important question, which is fundamentally that of, well, it's absolutely true that sensible propositions about sensible things correspond to sensible objects. But the problem is, the world isn't just made of sensible things. And this isn't even to invoke any sort of theological array of various beings, or even to invoke God or a spiritual reality. It's simply in virtue of when we analyze what really goes into even our most basic knowledge structures, we find that there's all sorts of non-empirical stuff going on there. Mm-hmm. And so I'm going to come back to Kant. I'm just going to skip ahead a tiny bit and jump straight into precisely how this works here. So if sidq al-qadiyya is mutabaqatu hali nafs al-amr. So our traditional correspondence theory, the traditional correspondence theory in Islamic thought, and this is pretty much universal. Of course, there's huge differences in terms of detail and in terms of what various schools actually identify things as they are, nafs al-amr as, what is nafs al-amr. But we'll get on to that. Just in terms of what we're discussing now, which is what is the correspondence theory? It's essentially the following. It's this formulation, and this is an actual formulation that you'll find all throughout the Islamic sciences. So it's sidq al-qadiyya mutabaqatuha li nafs al-amr. And what that means is the truth of a proposition amounts to or is its correspondence, i.e. the correspondence of the proposition, to nafs al-amr, which can be translated as objective reality, things as they really are, and even things in themselves, although I'd rather not, because it makes you think of Kant. But sidq al-qadiyya mutabaqatu, and I don't want anyone to have to go for CPR. But in any case, so yeah, that's basically it. The truth of a proposition is its correspondence to nafs al-amr, to objective reality. Mm-hmm. I said that's very nice and neat if we want to hold on, as long as we're able to hold on to the idea that all reality is sensible reality, that somehow we can reduce every proposition to some sort of sensible referent or some sort of empirical content. But the problem faced by any philosopher worth his salt throughout the history of philosophy is, well, then how do we account for the truth of propositions which do not possess empirical reference? Mm-hmm. So here are just some conceptions or objects which are various kinds, whether they're mental or extra mental, which they're not actually empirical in any straightforward way. So one is an army. Now, what exists outside in extramental reality are individual human beings. There are no armies existing in extramental reality, and I think zooming in on exactly what we mean by this will be very helpful. Extramental reality in the Islamic tradition, al-kharij, literally al-kharij means outside, so it's kharij al-dhihn, what's outside the mind, is all particular. Right. Extramental reality is all particular. So if you look at the outside world, or even the desk that you're sitting in front of, and all of the various objects which are scattered around the room, every existent object is in Arabic, it's yaqbal al-ishara al-hissiyya. So it's capable of being pointed at. it can in principle be singled out, and it's as crude as it sounds, by being pointed at. So I can single out, you know, this lamp here, because it's an individual object, which I can single out as particularly itself and not something else. It is that particular lamp, and it's other than this particular book. It's a particular thing. To exist extra mentally is to be particular. It's to be particularized. It's to be an individual. Now, armies are definitely real, but there are no armies as such an extra mental reality, because all that exists in extra mental reality are particular things. So there are particular human beings. There's that human being, that human being, that, and then we consider them to be an army. Now, if other non-human creatures were to look at these individuals behaving strangely together, they would just see lots of individuals behaving in a certain manner, but they wouldn't consider this to be an army, because armies don't exist extramentally. They're not individual objects. It's a way of considering individuals. Now, the same with countries. Countries are definitely real as far as we know, but there's no extramental country. There's only individual objects, which we then consider this huge aggregate of objects to be what we call a country. And that's true of adherents of religions, Muslims, Christians, and schools of thought, and even the universe, because we consider the aggregate of individual entities that we call the universe as a whole, although we cannot experience the whole empirically. So this poses a problem for this simple correspondence theory. What does our term the universe correspond to? Because there are only individual objects out there. And then the relational categories, we'd have to talk about the categories. So let's move on to these propositions.
Can I just put just briefly a footnote that there is a school of thought that predates even Descartes called nominalism, I think associated with William of Ockham, a fellow Englishman. And this term nominalism coming from the Latin word nominalis, meaning of or pertaining to names. It's the idea that reality is only made up of particular items, and it denies the real existence of any general entities such as armies or properties or species or universals or any other categories. And I think I could be wrong. Ibn Taymiyyah, I think, was a nominalist in that sense. He denied the more Platonic sense of ideals or universal categories. But so nominalism is, you know, medieval in the sense that William Ockham was a medieval theologian and philosopher in England.
Absolutely. From Surrey, in fact, I believe.
Yes.
But they got a lot to answer for. But I mean, absolutely. Thank you for bringing up.
Excellent footnote, by the way. I don't mean to derail what you were saying. I was just this emphasis on particulars is the denial of abstractions. It's not just a post-Cartesian issue. It's also there in the medieval period as well.
Oh, absolutely. And that's a very apposite comment. Thank you. And we will discuss Ockham a bit later. As you say, some people ascribe nominalism to, they describe Ibn Taymiyyah is anomalous, and that is disputed. In fact, I have a few friends who would dispute that, but scholars working on that topic. But we'll discuss Ockham later, and particularly this thing called nominalism, which is extremely important. So we were looking at looking at distinct conceptions and objects and realities, whatever one wants to call them, which don't, they're definitely real, but you can't reduce them to any empirical content. When it comes to propositions, it becomes even clearer what we're talking about. So let's go through some propositions and ask the question, what do these propositions correspond to?
You're talking about good question.
Sorry?
So I was just agreeing. I was just a good question. Yes.
Well, precisely. So, I mean, this is really what the question of Nafs al-Amr comes down to. And this is even how it was framed, which is quite extraordinary, how it was framed in a lot of the key texts and the development of Nafs al-Amr theory throughout Islamic history. But so if we go back to our correspondence formula, the truth of a proposition is its correspondence to things in themselves, things as they are, objective reality, then how do we account for the truth of propositions which do not possess empirical reference, like these ones, metaphysical principles, which we know are true? But if we believe that truth is correspondence to reality, then it's not clear how they can be true, because they don't seem to correspond to anything. But if they don't correspond to anything, then are we forced to come to the conclusion that they are fundamentally subjective and we're actually imposing them upon reality? Now, just to make it really crude, as it, I'm afraid, has to be in this type of, I mean, whatever presentation you're giving anywhere, as you know, as Paul knows very, very well, things have to be kind of boiled down an awful lot. But so, I mean, to a scholar, it's kind of abhorrent crudity, but it's true. This is fundamentally what motivated Kant's denial of our knowledge of things in themselves, of our ability to know things as they really are in themselves. Namely, the problem of abstract propositions, which we know to be true, but we can't root in extramental reality, in reality outside of the mind in any way. So to go through a few of them, metaphysical principles, nothing comes from nothing. Definitely true, doesn't correspond to anything. Syllogistic reasoning about general metaphysics. This is just a famous argument in Arabic philosophy. Kul ma'adum mutamayiz wa kul mutamayiz thabit fa kullu ma'adum in thabit. Every abstract object, I mean, it's really non-existent entity, but we don't need to explain that now. Every abstract object is distinct. Every distinct thing is subsistent. Therefore, every abstract object is subsistent. The formal structures of logic, like the first figure of the syllogism, for example, every A is B and every B is C, so every A is C, definitely true, doesn't correspond to anything in extramental reality. Logical and metaphysical principles, principle of non-contradiction, both in terms of, as a logical principle, as a principle of being, a thing cannot be and not be at the same time and in the same respect. I mean, that's the basis of all of our knowledge. But again, what does it correspond to in reality, such that we can be assured that it's actually true? It's not just a subjective principle that we happen to be equipped with as the type of beings that we happen to be, but if we were some sort of strange alien from another galaxy, we might be equipped with completely different principles, look upon the same world, and just not see the same things. We didn't have that. We weren't equipped with the principle of non-contradiction. So that's the doubt there. Then classificatory intelligibles, modal statements, his son would be a capable dentist, which we use every day. Future contingents, the world will still exist tomorrow, doesn't actually correspond to anything, even though we know that it's true. Historical facts, fictional definitions, which is a bit less problematic. Propositions about ontological status, being a senator is a social construct, for example. Gender is not a social construct, for example. Then we've got mathematical models of physical reality, like this delightful one here, which are supposed, you know, which are meant to describe, according to scientific realism, the way that the world somehow really is in its fundamental structure. But it's just a bunch of mathematics, and so on a correspondence theory, you'd have to account for how the reference of these mathematical objects are actually rooted in reality, if at all. So another one would be methodological statements. I love this one because all meaningful statements spot the contradiction. I mean, this is a beautiful self-refuting statement. All meaningful statements are either analytic or empirically verified.
I mean, for me, that's actually a joke. When I read that, I laugh. I mean, because it's self-refuting, you know, because okay, this is a meaningful statement, presumably, that the person wants us to believe. Okay, but you've just said all meaningful statements must be either analytic, in other words, tautological, basically, or verifiable. But how do you verify that statement? It's something that it goes beyond either analytical truths or empirical truths, so it's actually a joke.
Exactly, it's a joke, and but this was, as you know, the verification principle, which
logical positivism, yes,
logical positivism shaped so much philosophy in the first half of the 20th century, yeah, especially in Oxford and Cambridge.
Frédéric, of course, the Englishman, was one of the chief culprits. Later on in life, he actually decided it was all bunkum anyway.
Precisely, and it's actually a notable instance of real philosophical progress that this was basically identified by every professional philosopher as bunk. Mm. And so they moved on, but the truth is they moved on to the impasse, really, that we're presently in, where everything's now been discredited and we just have no idea what to do and what to think. And so the next one is, all true knowledge constitutes a fusion of sensible intuition and concept. That's dear old Kant's one. Mm-hmm. So, you know, for Kant, the experience, which for him is the only true form of knowledge, it has to be this fusion of time and space, the intuitions of time and space, which are subjectively imposed upon the world. We're not really in time and space. It's just that it looks like that to us because we're imposing, our cognitive apparatuses are imposing time and space on the world, and concept, which are all of the, what he calls concepts of the understanding, which make what would otherwise be this kind of indistinct blur of stuff. We don't know what it is.
Want to read more about that? It's all in this very short and easily understandable book. Sorry, I'm being
sarcastic. Oh, absolutely. Please go ahead. Yeah.
It's a good view,
isn't it? One. I can't see you. All I can see is my screen. So.
Oh, I see. No, I was just holding up a copy of The Critic of Pure Reason. I was being ironic.
Oh, you're being ironic.
It's very long and very difficult.
Crouton.
Yes.
Sorry, I've ruined that. all true knowledge constitutes a fusion of sensible intuition and concept. Absolutely. Go to this delightful...
That's the one, yes.
Beautiful bedtime reading.
Beautiful bedtime reading, guaranteed to put you to sleep within seconds.
Absolutely.
If you don't, I'll give you nightmares, depending on your...
So you have the concepts of the understanding, relation and unity and substance and various concepts, which he feels we also need to impose upon the world for it to make sense. Now, again, spot the contradiction here. All true knowledge constitutes a fusion of sensible intuition and concept, except this sentence.
Which is the exception to the rule.
Yeah. And then his favorite one, and the worst of all, really, is we cannot have knowledge of things in themselves except this sentence.
Which shows we do have some knowledge of things of themselves. But how do you know that? Oh, I'm not going to go there. This is a very problematic statement, isn't it? We cannot have knowledge of things in themselves. How can we be meaningful about things in themselves if we cannot have any knowledge about things in themselves? How do we know they even exist if we don't have any knowledge of them?
Exactly. Exactly. Mm. I think that's a point that Sheikh Mustafa Sabri makes in his critique of Kant. And I think you've had a guest recently
who
discussed that.
Yes.
So wonderful. I'm not sure why that beautiful carpet's there.
Oh, it's very welcome, actually, after pictures of Kant. See that?
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Some Islamic art.
So I don't know. There's so much more here. I mean, how do you think we should proceed now?
Is it possible? I mean, this is a very challenging thing. Just to summarize again what Kant's contribution is to epistemology. Because he himself modestly characterized his philosophy as a Copernican revolution.
Yeah.
So, you know, Copernicus, the great Polish astronomer, a couple of centuries before, said, look, basically, the Earth is not the center of the universe. The sun is the center of our solar system, and we go around the sun. So he changed from a geocentric to a heliocentric cosmology. Mm-hmm. And this was a revolution in the way we see the universe, of course. Analogously, Kant saw his philosophy as a revolution in our perception of the universe in an analogous way. It was a revolution. And I think he was right in his claim to be a revolutionary, I mean.
Absolutely.
And is it possible to summarize how that revolution, what it was? I know it's a complex subject, but would you be able to
Absolutely.
Do that?
I mean, would you like me to... try to summarize it, although I'm sure you probably do a better job, but I could try to summarize it, or I could go in a few more slides a bit more in depth about why he was moved to.
Well, I leave it entirely up to you, Hassan. I don't in any way to tell you what to do. It's just I think it's worth just dwelling at some point anyway a bit more on Kant's revolution in philosophy, because it affects everything after him.
It affects absolutely everything. Yeah, so I mean, to summarize it briefly first, how did we get to a situation which people think that an act of will can actually make them, let's say I'm a man at the moment, and just after our conversation, I suddenly feel that I'm really not a man. I'm actually really, and I'm not in any way, I mean, it's a bit glib, a bit facetious the way that I'm expressing it, but it's in no way meant to be disrespectful. But, you know, I stay up throughout the night thinking, I really am a woman. I'm not a man. I there's something about me, just something ineffable, which is really not a man. It's really a woman. And I'm going to be a woman. And I've decided that I'm going to self-identify a woman. I'm free. I'm an individual. It's my right. I own my own being. And there's no one who can determine really for me what I am. And all of this stuff about being a woman and gender and femininity and masculinity is all a social construct anyway. It's something we've created. So the idea that I should have to be bound by a social construct, which someone else or circumstances or history or where I happen to have been born has imposed upon me, when in fact I find that I incline as a person much more to that social construct of femininity, is simply absurd. And it's simply an oppressive imposition of someone else because of power interests and because people want to control us, essentially, of someone else's vision of who I should be upon me. And I have to live my truth because I own my own being and my own individuality. And so I can make that choice. And the others will have to accept it because, well, surely they would themselves also want their own decisions, their own choices about who and what they are to be respected. And we have to, you know, society has to be built on that basis. Now, the fact that that line of reasoning is so widely accepted today is really because of Kant. And I'm afraid the way that that works is fundamentally the following. Kant said, everything non-empirical is purely subjective, ultimately. And the only reason we can, in some, really in a kind of quote-unquote way, not a real way, but empirical knowledge, maths and physics is quote-unquote objective, not really objective because it's not really things in themselves, but we can have natural sciences, we can have mathematics, those are real sciences we can do, because they don't purport to transcend what we can experience. So the nature of our cognitive apparatus is the way that we naturally cognize the world, the way we happen to find that we cognize the world, really, for Kant, is in terms of certain concepts and categories and what he calls intuitions, which are really not mystical at all. They, for him, an intuition is simply sensation and time and space.
Yeah.
And what we can know of the world, truly know, as far as Kant is concerned, is only what we can experience. And what we can experience is only what we impose upon the world in virtue of our cognitive apparatus. Now, that imposition veils whatever the world really is in itself.
Right.
We don't know that. And we know that we can't know what the world really is in itself. That's a slight problem for Kant, as we discussed. We don't need to get into that now. But the point is, all we can know are the objects of experience. So maths and mathematics and physics, for example, work. We can have a science of metaphysics, which purports to tell you if there's a God or not. Now, Kant doesn't say that we can't prove the existence of God. He says we can't know either way. Strictly can't know either way. In virtue of our nature, the nature of our cognitive apparatus, we cannot know, even in principle, whether God exists or not. We cannot know, even in principle, whether there's life after death or not. We cannot, even in principle, know if we have a soul or what the soul would be if we had one, or whether it survives death, and so on. A long list of metaphysical questions, he says, are not even in principle knowable. Why? Because they transcend all possible experience.
Yeah.
So
in one fair swoop, then, traditional metaphysics, theology, is consigned to the dustbin because we're simply not equipped as a species to apprehend those truths. They are way beyond our pay grade, to use a hideous analogy. Yeah, we don't have the cognitive ability to speak meaningfully of these transcendent realities because they're way beyond our experience. So he basically he looks at the five arguments of the existence of God in the Critique of Pure Reason, and in his view finds them woefully inadequate. Although I must say, people have responded to his arguments since and push back against his critiques. But so traditional metaphysics is consigned to the dustbin. Although I must stress, I always, before I read Kant, I always used to think he was an atheist. He wasn't. He himself believed in God. He was kind of a Lutheran. He was a child of Lutheran parents, a very pietistic background. And there's a particular Lutheran understanding of one's relationship with God and that human will and the world around us and natural theology, which we won't go into. But there is, I think, an influence on that Lutheran, from that Lutheran ethos, in the way he's quite down on natural theology and retreats
this kind of. Absolutely. And in fact, I mean, that is something I did want to move on to, was that Lutheran and Occamist background, because of course Luther was an Occamist philosopher, and that was his training as a theologian. And he was although he repudiated the scholastic reason as a tool for knowing God and interpreting the Bible and for theological knowledge, he was nonetheless trained up to the to the hilt
He was a professor of theology in university.
So how do we jump from Kant's repudiation of our knowledge of things in themselves to the present? Well, it's the idea that all of that stuff which is not strictly empirical knowledge, that's fair game.
Because and also the idea of human autonomy is really central to his ethics as well. The human individual is autonomous and should be autonomous over against any external influence on them. They should act from within in terms of their own sense of duty. It's a very Prussian ethic, you know. But this idea of human autonomy is central, I think, to his conception of the human being and the individual. And this is a very Enlightenment idea, and this feeds directly into the kind of discourse that you mentioned from that Berkeley person. The autonomy, my body, my right, my universe, I decide. And that's kind of extreme version of Kant, isn't it, I think?
It absolutely is. And it goes back to this question of how can we have a science in the in the traditional sense, you know, which in the medieval world was scientia, in the Arabic tradition, ilm. How can we have a science, not in point I'm making, not modern science, traditional science, in the sense of certain knowledge, how can we have a science of non-empirical discourse? I'd just like to illustrate that now, I think, which will be helpful by contrasting different understandings of knowledge structures. So this, if I just enter the full screen again, here we are. This is the most prevalent contemporary model. We have models of you know, what you might call the hierarchy of the sciences. Now, people today, because of their ideological affiliations and beliefs and commitments, would be loath to actually invoke any notion of an intrinsic hierarchy of anything. But, the de facto queen of the sciences, I think we can all pretty much agree today, is physics.
But you use the expression queen of the sciences. I just stress the irony of that, of course, because traditionally the queen of the sciences was theology. Because what can trump theology? Discourse about God surely is the highest preoccupation of the human mind. And that has now been dethroned, in the Western context at least, by, as you say, the queen of the sciences, now physics, these fundamental elements of material reality. So there's been a complete inversion of the traditional world perception.
Absolutely. And so, you know, we have a situation today where the so-called hard sciences, the fully objective, truly empirically grounded sciences, which are alone the real sciences, are physics, biology, and chemistry, most fundamentally. Biology and chemistry can ultimately be reduced to physics, because obviously physics describes the larger universe, which is a precondition for the objects of the biology and chemistry studies to have come into existence. And then you have this lesser rung of sciences that some would even call pseudosciences, but which have some scientific elements, significant empirical basis or quantifiability, again, going back to what, you know, Descartes and that shift in the understanding of what science is, which took place in terms of the distinction between primary and secondary qualities, and the idea that all we can really by right study of the natural and physical world is what is quantifiable, whatever is quantifiable. And so psychology and sociology and economics, they have significant quantifiability in an empirical basis, but not entirely. There's a lot of subjective stuff that we're that we're also bringing to bear there. So they have a kind of disputed and lesser status. Another might be anthropology. And then scant empirical basis quantifiability would be history and philosophy, including metaphysics. And then purely subjective, non-quantifiable, would be literature, law and politics and religion, for example. So this is an incredible inversion of this scheme.
Ah, here we go. The Queen of Science is back on her throne again. Metaphysics at the top.
Precisely. And so we'll go through this scheme a tiny bit in a moment. But again, I mean, just to explore what the widespread view, which again, I mean, I grew up with this view. I mean, I went to an ordinary state school in Cambridge, and this is what I happened to have a strong influence from my home environment, because my parents were converts to Islam who converted in the early 70s. And they had to a large degree inoculated me against this stuff, but I understood this perspective from you know, as a native, and this is what we all grew up in, which is this idea that there is this stark distinction. I didn't write this, by the way. This is just taken from the internet, and it's from the perspective of someone who believes this. But it's this stark separation between humanities and sciences. So it's the idea again. That comes down to that issue of non-empirical discourse, and can we have a science of non-empirical discourse? And post-Kantian modernity basically says, no, you can't have a science of non-empirical discourse. Therefore, you better put up with the fact that you can have quantifiable knowledge of the natural world, which is alone what we would call objective. It's not really objective because you don't really know what things are in themselves, but let's say it's intersubjective, so we can all agree about it. So, you know, the real sciences are positivist in the sense that they have empirical reference. You can point to something outside in some way or other, whether it's even if it's, you know, through a telescope or in a microscope or whatever it happens to be. They're objective, they're transparent, they're data oriented. And, you know, they lead to findings, discoveries, facts, laws, progress, and so on. And you achieve them by the scientific method. There's methods, there's hypothesis testing, there's modeling and so on. Whereas the humanities, poor old humanities, are fundamentally relativist. It's just what you happen to think of it. No matter how sophisticated or eloquent you are, at the end of the day, it's relative, it's subjective, it's intuitive, it's introspective. And people might say, oh, it's very important. You know, humans do need this. And of course, it's true that we do need the humanities. But what is not necessarily so clearly true is the idea that there is this sharp distinction between what are really objective, so-called objective sciences, which are empirical sciences, and everything else, which is almost everything, actually, including our philosophies about the world, our theologies, all of our aesthetic valuations, or our moral valuations, our ethics. It's all fundamentally on this model, ultimately subjective.
Well, of course, even this is out of date in terms of science, because since Einstein and quantum mechanics, you know, we're now very much aware, at the quantum level at least, of the role of the observer in an outcome of experiments, the influence of the observer himself in the way experiments occur and the outcome of those experiments. So isn't this neat kind of separation between the observed world and the observer? There is now an interaction between them, even in science now. I mean, it's obviously in physics.
Yeah.
So even this model is out of date and more Newtonian than Einsteinian in that sense.
It absolutely is. And although I should add the proviso, of course, as you know, that there are many scientists today, including some very prominent ones like Roger Penrose, who desperately want to deny that interpretation of quantum physics and the idea that there is a role. That the observer is in some sense actually affecting the physical outcome. Because again, it's just impossible to compute in terms of that, that the certain, what I would call prejudices, but certain assumptions about the nature of the physical world. How can you factor in the knowing subject? Again, in our tradition, in the broad Islamic tradition, and specifically, more inclined to the Akbarian and the Platonic traditions, but it's much easier to account for that continuity between the knowing subject and the object. In fact, in a real sense, they are the same thing. And so it's not such a kind of unfathomable mystery to see how there could be some causal relation between the two. So here, you know, the active assumption here is that non-empirical discourse is irredeemably subjective. And this assumption grounds the volerentist ontologies that make the supreme value free choice regardless of what is chosen, which is, you know, essentially the mantra of the Judith Butlers and others of this world.
This expression voluntarist ontologies, voluntarist refers to the will, is it the human will making choice? Is that what you mean by
absolutely? And you know, at the outset we spoke about the current zeitgeist, which is the idea that, well, we can make our own reality somehow. There's no real reality out there. We're going to make what we are. We're going to decide not just what we're going to do, which is pretty reasonable, but we're actually going to decide what we are. That's also up to us. And that's why I'm calling it a voluntarist ontology, because the idea that ontology is actually subject to will, our will.
Right.
We're actually making the way that the world is. And that goes back to, again, Kant. I mean, it was beautifully epitomized by Sartre's famous statement that that being is prior to essence, and that there's no human nature. There's only our pure freedom, and we will only become human later when we construct and create our own human nature out of
it. Sartre is very explicit. There is no God in his view. Therefore, we are free to create this reality and in the way you described. So it's premised on atheism.
Absolutely.
He's very explicit about that. But also, I remind of another Englishman, Aleister Crowley, just occurred to me, who... would consider him a Satanist. I mean, he was a purveyor of the occult. We won't go into this, but you know, I think his mantra, his credo was, you know, "Do what thou wilt, do what thou wilt." So just exercise your will as you wish, and this is satanic in one understanding. It's the opposite. The Islamic understanding is very much that God's will is paramount in the person's life, because he is our creator and sustainer, and intends good for us. But for the Satanist or even the modern zeitgeist, it's, well, I am my own God, and I do as I will. And this seems to be a satanic inversion of traditional theology.
Absolutely. And I mean, it makes you think of the beautiful verse out of Lamech Tanjim, "Afra'ita man ittakhadha ilahu hawa." Have you not seen he who takes his own self as his God? Yes. Not himself, his own caprice.
Yeah,
his own caprice as his God, and yes, of course. I mean, with Sartre, absolutely. He said there is no human nature because there is no God to have an idea of it.
Yes.
So yes, it very fundamentally comes down to that. This is to be contrasted with this traditional understanding of the hierarchy of the sciences, which interestingly was very substantially shared between the Islamic world and medieval Europe.
And Christian Europe,
And Christian Europe, absolutely, and to a large degree, the earlier Neoplatonist situation. So, so this is fundamentally where there is a supreme science, which they would call al-ilm al-a'la. It's what's known in the medieval world as first philosophy. In Arabic, metaphysics, tameteta fusika in Aristotle, that which comes after metaphysics. There's a dispute about whether that's just, as you know, the way that books happen to be edited, that it came after physics or not. I find that a bit unlikely personally, that that's all there is to it, but God knows best. It's called first philosophy, and sometimes the universal science. And it is the science which is responsible for all of the other sciences. All of the other sciences are subordinate to metaphysics in that traditional model. And they're subordinate in a different way to revelation and theology. Yeah. In a way, metaphysics is our journey up, because it's our existence of knowing subjects on our epistemological journey, trying to find out the truth. And that's what metaphysics allows us to do. In a way, revelation is what's coming down to us.
Yes.
And so they have that kind of relationality.
And I guess it's very hierarchical as well. There's a clear hierarchy of truth here, from the lesser to the greater, to the little, to the more, unlike the alternative paradigm you mentioned.
Absolutely. And this is seen to be a hierarchical ordering which mirrors a hierarchical structure of being. And as you see here, mathematics and logic are so important, but they have they've got no place in this de facto hierarchy, because they have no empirical basis. But the sciences cannot operate without them. And this is a big problem for scientists who are more philosophically informed and attuned today, because they can't be reduced to physical properties. And this is a real problem for scientists, and we can't not use them, but they're not physical realities, and it's very difficult to consistently construe them as physical realities. And as such, well, does that mean again that our knowledge is irredeemably subjective?
Yeah. You mentioned Roger Penrose, the great British cosmologist. What is the status of mathematics? Is it a creation of the human mind, or is it like a Platonic form that has some kind of independent existence from our minds? I think he inclines to the latter, but that's a different subject.
Absolutely, and he has some very interesting works on that, and I very much respect the degree of philosophical attunement that Roger Penrose enjoys, and the fact that he takes it seriously, and unlike so many modern philosophers. Shameless self-promotion, I don't think, in the slightest, but since you mentioned hierarchy,
yes,
this is a remarkably concise and inexpensive new book coming out this month. Hierarchy.
Would you highly recommend it, would you, by coincidence?
Well, I was hoping you'd recommend it, actually.
But I've been silly. Of course, you are the author of this amazing book. No, I'm very much looking forward to. I like the title a lot, Hierarchy and Freedom, an examination of some classical, metaphysical, and post-Enlightenment accounts of human autonomy. So it kind of covers a lot of things there.
So it's very apposite for what we're talking about. And I think to explain a little bit of the argument there, and we see how all of this is related. I mean, Robert Pippin, I know that a lot of this is going to be very heavy, and we've brought in a lot of different things, and I beg the forgiveness of the listener for just how much we're piling on here. But I mean, one of the ways to understand the broad narratives which are at play here and informed by the philosophy is to read some of the great intellectual historians like Robert Pippin, like Charles Taylor, for example. And Robert Pippin has a beautiful book called Modernism as a Philosophical Problem. And one of the things that he says there is that the most characteristically modern claim of the modern individual espousing the philosophies of modernity is this assertion, exactly as you were saying, Paul, of autonomy and of this radical individual freedom, and that in some real way there is nothing else. And that is what's that's the gift that modernity has given us. It's freed us from all of those false strictures and those false hierarchies and those, these claimed intrinsic hierarchy. And now it's even freed us from, these social constructs like gender and the family and even human nature that we'd previously thought were part of the real fabric of being. And this was only possible, as Pippin shows and as Charles Taylor and others show, because of this sense of having dismantled the hierarchy. There's this assumption, again, following on from the general trajectory of Western thought, from what is called nominalism in Occam and then through Descartes and into Kant, this general trajectory of believing that there's not only not an intrinsic nature of individual objects don't have intrinsic natures, but their context of being has no intrinsic order either. So there's no intrinsic ordering of being. Nothing is really intrinsically superior to anything else. Nothing is really intrinsically metaphysically prior to anything else, because we wouldn't be able to know that. And so it was seen that what is actually, in actual fact, the Dionysian, pseudo-Dionysian vision of the hierarchy of not only the metaphysical hierarchy, but the metaphysical hierarchy being reflected in the orders of society. So, you know, the idea that in medieval society, everyone's locked into their place. You know, the serf has to remain in his place as the serf, and the lord of the manor has a higher position than him. And, you know, the knight and the tradesperson and the king and all these people are locked in a particular position. And of course, the religious hierarchy is at the top. And in a way, and that this somehow reflects a hierarchy of being. So the church hierarchy is going to be reflecting the angelic hierarchy, for example. The ecclesiastical hierarchy is going to be reflecting the angelic hierarchy, and everyone is taking their rightful place. And that's why people lacked their real freedom to determine their own lives, because they were locked into this false conception of intrinsic hierarchy. You know, you've got someone like Pippin who says, individualist notions of freedom are often viewed as a response to a collapse in the authority of the classical or pre-modern view of freedom as the true realization of one's identity or nature. So it's a completely different conception of freedom. Such a view did not require a search within for an individual nature of self, just the opposite. Realizing one's true nature in this traditional view, and so being fully free, instead required finding one's place or role in something outside oneself, first in the polis or social community, and ultimately in nature or the whole. By understanding that one could only be oneself by realizing this function within the whole, rather than, as sometimes interpreted, sacrificing oneself for the sake of the whole, one could achieve a satisfying and finally free life. The widespread collapse of the metaphysical support for such a view of an ordered hierarchical cosmos or divine order is what, on many accounts, provoked the modern assertion of freedom as a radically individual self-determination, particularly in Charles Taylor's, he's referring to Source of the Self. Since there were, it seemed, only individuals having to rely primarily on themselves in deciding what to do, the primary task of modern civilization looked to be finding a way of allowing each to realize effectively the results of such self-determination.
And that is absolutely fascinating. If I can just give, I can't help but offer just a few responses to that. In terms, this is a very European, Eurocentric issue, isn't it? This revolt against a church, in the Reformation's emphasis on the individual belief, Martin Luther, we mentioned him already, over against an ecclesiastical tradition, that's quite key, and the rise of modern liberalism as a result, in part, of the wars of religion that took place in Europe, people were exhausted by the killing and the carnage and the endless wars between Catholics and Protestants and so on. And so you get born the liberal social order, this alleged neutral space where people could resolve their differences. All of this, however true it may be, is very much a European headache, isn't it? It's not something that organically comes out of an Islamic perspective or any other perspective. And yet today, it seems, it's assumed to be universalizable. It's just a universal, natural state of affairs.
Absolutely.
But this emphasis on the individual, you know, goes back, as you say, to the Reformation, which is heavily theological, that you see again in Kant, the idea of human autonomy. And this feeds through, ultimately, this individualist conception of the human being. But I keep on stressing that this is a very much a localized, geographically particular part of the world, North Europe and the United States. But because of other issues, it's become a universal ideology impinging even Muslims in the Muslim world now. And that's why it's becoming really dangerous, because Islam is very different from this ideology.
Absolutely. And that beautifully, almost as if you had prior knowledge of what's in my... That beautifully feeds into to this next section, which is, why is this such an idiosyncratically Western phenomenon?
Yes.
Not only this trajectory of what I consider to be the deterioration of thought through Occam and Descartes and so on, but also the what it resulted in, which is this radical self-determination of and freedom, what is really arbitrary freedom, freedom regardless of what is chosen, as this ultimate human goal and ideal. And I suppose, probably this should be, I would expect, the last section, because I just feel that I'm blathering on too much. Well, that's very kind of you. But
there's so much to say. What one can't only scratch the surface in any particular area.
Exactly. And there are many other things I wanted to go into, but I think...
maybe another time if it's too much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think this will probably wrap up what we've been discussing beautifully. So I consider this to be the result, and really to be this really truly to be the case, that this idiosyncratic flavor of Western thought resulting in such a distinctive and particular and strange and extreme result of this idea that somehow individuals decide ontology and the way that existent things really should be and can be and are, paradoxically comes from a theological discussion, which just happened to be the most important thing in existence to medieval civilization in the West, Christian civilization. And this is the question of the perplexing doctrines of the Trinity and the Incarnation. The early Middle Ages, often referred to as the Dark Ages, and the High Middle Ages, which is basically Bonaventura and Aquinas, and after the conquest of Toledo and the establishment of the universities, that period of synthesis and high culture, and then the late Middle Ages, which is after the Black Death and the decline and Occam and all sorts of controversies in the church, the late Middle Ages, each possessed a distinct and characteristic way of treating the relationship between revelation and reason.
Mm.
So the perplexing doctrines of the Trinity and the Incarnation, the holy mysteries, as they're known, though productive of ever-present tensions, nonetheless continually suggested the justifiability of exceptionalist self-definitions of Europe as Christendom, which I would argue continues to this day, the idea that the West somehow, as manifest great, to tragic effect in the invasion of Iraq, the idea that the West has something really special that everyone else needs and we alone have it. And it's to the extent that, because we alone have access to this liberating truth, it's really justified even to go around imposing it upon people. Because otherwise,
in Qatar, in the World Cup, the Western attitude everywhere to Qatar as a Muslim country is that you must change because we in the West know better than you. Doesn't matter what you think, simply because we are right. It's axiomatic the West is right. It's supreme arrogance, actually, which I'm glad to say people are pushing back against now in the Muslim world, as far as I can see.
Yeah, and even unexpected people here, like Piers Morgan, which is interesting. but you know, credit is you know, where it's due and everything. So the perplexing, we already did that. After all, the faithful believers in a creed about God so radically different from that of the Jews and the Muslims must either be severely misled, a possibility which clearly could not be countenanced by them, or instead be God's new chosen people, alone privy to a staggering new revelation of admittedly intuitive truths not known or even imagined by the other great monotheistic peoples of the world, or even by Moses.
Very well said.
The idea that the problems posed by these holy mysteries were amongst the primary contributors to the distinctive attitudes to faith and reason ushered in by the rise of the scientific and Protestant revolutions is perhaps a paradoxical thesis, but is nonetheless one that is richly evidence. The insurmountability of these problems eventually cemented a notion of the complete otherness of faith and reason that is unrecognizable outside of Christendom. The secular project itself, and indeed modernity, in turn arose in the West precisely because of a radical split that was effected there between supernatural and natural knowledge, largely as the result, I think, of changes in the manner in which the holy mysteries came to be treated. The first of these ways of approaching the mysteries is associated especially with Anselm of Canterbury, who's 11th century, as you can see, Richard of St. Victor, and William of Auvergne, justified according to a strongly Platonist scheme modified to accommodate the idiosyncrasies of Christian doctrine. Of course, actually, there's nothing more antithetical than Platonism and Christianity, as Porphyry was very eager to point out in his famous critique of Christianity. But nonetheless, that didn't stop Augustine. So the Trinity and the Incarnation were viewed as being capable of actual proof, were underlain by necessary reasons, and thus form part of the domain directly accessible to reason. So essentially, I see these three stages corresponding to the early Middle Ages, the so-called Dark Ages, the High Period, so-called High Period, and the later period, being the move from thinking that this most important aspect of, or these most important of all doctrines, the Trinity Incarnation, upon which the salvation was thought to rest, went from the attitude went from the idea that they are part of the continuous with reason and actually provable by reason, to the view that they can't be proved by reason, but they're merely compatible with reason. They don't contradict reason. They can work together. So that's Aquinas's kind of fragile harmony that he affected, which we'll see now. And then moving to Ockham, who said, unfortunately, they are formally contradictory and actually oppose reason, we've noticed. But that basically means there's something wrong with reason, and we'll just have faith. And so our understanding of faith will move towards that completely unrecognizable to Islamic philosophy, understanding of faith as blind faith. It's this leap of faith that somehow is this virtuous act, but it's no evidence whatsoever.
Soren Kierkegaard, of course, the great Christian philosopher, Danish philosopher, made a virtue out of that.
And of course, you know, one can't dismiss a thinker of his weight, but it's just interesting how that kind of attitude does come out of this trajectory of this ultimate, this kind of broad trajectory of Western thought. It was prior to the conquest of Toledo in 1085, an annexation that sparked a seismic shift in the knowledge structures of Christian Europe with the discovery and subsequent translation in the latter half of the 12th century of the logical works amongst Aristotle's Organon. Of course, they lacked most of Aristotle's Organon. They only had a little bit of what Boethius had summarized, and of Avicenna's and Aristotle's metaphysics, and of Avicenna's subalternated model of the sciences and his scientific metaphysics in his Al-Shifat, the healing, it was prior to the conquest of Toledo that these continuations of the Platonic spirit of Augustine of Hippo were defined in an intellectual context that made no clear distinction between philosophy and theology. A principle employed by Augustine rooted in Isaiah 7:9 and sometimes translated, unless you believe, you surely will not understand, would go on to be central to the approach of the theologians of the so-called Dark Ages, or be articulated by Anselm in the 11th century by his famous phrase, credo ut intelligam, I believe so that I may understand.
Yeah.
Knowledge of any type depends upon the illumination granted by faith. Reason illuminated by faith attains the truth. Anselm of Canterbury, so representing this this first approach, advanced his theory of atonement in his influential Cur Deus Homo, Why Did God Become a Man? Radically estranged from God through sin, this is kind of the argument, man has the obligation to make amends in order that God and man might be reconciled, and man might fulfill the debt of honour he owes to God. And yet, informing his reason with prior principles from his faith, Anselm assures us that that reconciliation could never be effected by any ordinary human being. For the logical necessity discoverable by the human intellect, this makes the reality of a God-man necessary.
And this idea of a debt of honour is a very feudal understanding of soteriology. It's not found, in the early patristic sources. This is very much of its time, I think, and place.
And just before this, I was watching your debate with Rowan Williams, and well done, by the way. That was beautiful. But did brilliant. I was cheering you on. But
my goodness me, it wasn't a debate, by the way. It wasn't supposed to. I was told by Cambridge University, do not debate Rowan Williams, the Archbishop of Canterbury. But I was a bit naughty because I decided during the Q&A to make certain comments which were slightly meant to trigger a response from him. So I managed to subtly engineer a debate, I was told not to do that. So I was a bit naughty, actually.
Well, I mean,
trade secrets coming out here.
Yeah, no, that was really very heartening. In any case, you were discussing. In Islam, God doesn't need to kill himself in order to forgive us. So the highly influential, that wasn't very sensitively stated, sorry. The highly influential theologian, prior of the Abbey of St. Victor near Paris, Richard of St. Victor, so this is another one who's representative really of this early approach, perpetuated Anselm's notion that it should be possible to find necessary reasons for the mysteries. For according to Christian belief, the Trinity, being God, possesses necessary existence, and God's necessary, the Trinity's necessary, and so it follows that there should be necessary reasons. Richard of St. Victor's articulation of this necessity invokes the perfection that God must necessarily possess in order to be God. God must have perfect love, yet perfect love requires the sharing of that love with another person. Moreover, the perfection of love amongst these two persons requires loving for the sake of a third. God possesses the perfection of love, and thus God must be three persons.
This argument, by the way, is used by Christian missionaries even today at Speaker's Corner, I kid you not.
Really?
As a way of beating Muslims and saying, aha, God must, if God is love, there must be this Trinity, this communion of persons, as it's called in theological, so particularly in the Orthodox understanding of the Trinity. I'm not going to go down there, but this is actually used today. I've actually heard it used at Speaker's Corner.
Amazing. Wow. Richard of St. Victor's, long reach. amazing. So, this is where the change happens. We're in the period of the cathedral schools. It's before the founding of the universities. It's, before the knowledge discovered in Toledo is fully assimilated. It's the so-called Dark Ages. I think it's actually a beautiful period in many, many ways in Christian Europe. But it is what we would consider possibly to be a somewhat naive view of the relationship between faith and reason. And there was just, but again, it comes from a laudable place in a way, because it was understanding that there is, reality is one, everything's integrated. If this is part of the deposit of faith and is a true doctrine from God, then it must make sense. It must be reflected in the world. There must be traces of the Trinity everywhere. It must be imprinted on our minds. And so then this subtle change, well, not so subtle change as it happens, takes place. So when the lost logical works of Aristotle became available in the early 13th century, particularly the Posterior Analytics that deals with the notion of strict scientific demonstration, again, in the traditional sense, I think it's worth just very briefly stating that the word science today has been co-opted by what traditionally would be understood to be just one very small and not particularly distinguished field of human investigation, which is the empirical dimension and what is testable in terms of the scientific method and so forth. That's become science, and that's all. You might add in you know, mathematics and formal logic, but fundamentally science is reduced to the what are called the hard sciences. Whereas in the traditional Christian world, and really arising from the discovery of the posterior analytics and the works of Ibn Sina and his Burhan particularly, scientia meant certain and indisputable, unequivocal, indubitable knowledge, regardless of what field that knowledge happened to obtain within. And the most scientific of the sciences was metaphysics. So the one which, you know, that which is considered to be most up for grabs and most subjective and most relative to the way you happen to look at things today was previously the supreme science that regulated all of the other sciences, that determined the principles of all of the other sciences, the science of first principles. And so knowledge in the Islamic tradition is sifatun tujibu tamyizan la yahtamilun naqid. So it is a attribute that human beings possess, come to possess, knowledge, that entails or effects with an E or necessitates an acts of discrimination in the traditional sense, acts of distinct cognition. So, you know, this thing is this thing and it's not that thing. And that thing is governed by the principle of identity. It is itself and it's not that thing. And they can't both be the same thing. And that's not just in the realm of sense. So it's a distinct, it's that faculty that cognizes the world in its distinctness. Mm-hmm. And not only in the realm of sensible things, but intelligible things as well. So, you know, the things, you know, the propositions of logic, of metaphysics, and so on, are governed by the principle of non-contradiction, and they are distinct in themselves. And so, you know, there is this fundamental and real structure which obtains between them. And so, this is a little digression because of talking about Avicenna's demonstrative metaphysics. And the notion of scientific demonstration, again, just very important to realize that this has nothing to do with modern science, who nicked that word from us, basically. So Avicenna's sophisticated demonstration, this is what they found in Toledo. And it hadn't, so this is the period of the so-called Dark Ages, the cathedral schools, and they literally didn't have this knowledge. And then it was in the process of assimilating this knowledge that, you know, the universities were born, Bologna first of all, and then, you know, Paris and Oxford and eventually
Cambridge.
Yeah. So when these works became available, a formal recognition of a type of knowledge and indeed of theological knowledge that could be known independently of faith became widespread. It became evident that with respect to pure reason, the putative proofs of the Trinity and the Incarnation were no more than sophistries, persuasive only to those who had already decided to have faith in those doctrines. And so it reaches this tipping point with Thomas Aquinas. So this is a quotation from his Summa Theologica, where he comes out and says very clearly, it is impossible to attain to the knowledge of the Trinity by natural reason. Whoever then tries to prove the Trinity of persons by natural reason, and the same holds true for the Incarnation, derogates from faith in two ways. Firstly, as regards the dignity of faith itself, which consists in its being concerned with invisible things that exceed human reason. Secondly, as regards the utility of drawing others to the faith, for when anyone in the endeavor to prove the faith brings forward reasons which are not cogent, he falls under the ridicule of the unbelievers. Who are the unbelievers? Probably the Muslims.
Muslims, yes. And the Jews.
And Jews, yeah, since they suppose that we stand upon such reasons and that we believe on such grounds. Therefore, we must not attempt to prove what is of faith, except by authority alone, to those who receive the authority, while as regards others, it suffices to prove that what faith teaches is not impossible. So the real effect of this weak conciliation of faith and reason, in which, though fundamentally separate, each supports and does not contradict the other, was simply to drive a wedge between reason and revelation as belonging to radically disparate orders. While the first broadly Platonic and Augustinian approach saw reason and revelation as forming an unbroken whole, and for Albert the Great and Aquinas, they were separate but complementary, here we get to the third stage of the later Middle Ages, the age of the crises of the later Middle Ages. The tradition initiated by Ockham, which was to be rendered a political, social, and doctrinal reality by Luther, taught that reason and revelation are separate and do not enjoy any complementarity at all. The pursuit of either one, entirely without reference to the other, is thus completely justified, for they are fundamentally irreconcilable. Indeed, this is the only reasonable way of proceeding. And this is a quote from Ockham himself, and this is in a very interesting book, Paul Tom, The Logic of the Trinity, Augustine to Ockham. Just as it is a singularity in God that a trinity are a thing one in number, in such a way that the thing one in number is each of those three things, so it is a singularity and beyond all that understanding that the inference, the essence that is one in number is the Son, the Father is not the Son, therefore the Father is not the essence, doesn't follow. So it's a singularity because it opposes the fundamental structures of formal logic. And so this, and he was such a great logician, and it really must be, it can't be overstated how important and advanced and extraordinary a logician William of Ockham was, that he saw this as and it was just something that couldn't be denied. It was plain as day to Ockham that there was this fundamental opposition of the holy mysteries to the structures of logic. And so this singularity should not be posited except when the authority of Holy Scripture compels. So look, Holy Scripture is allowed to distort logic itself. It's allowed to, you know, logic itself can be molded by Holy Scripture. And so such a consequence never should be denied in creatures, but the logical principle still holds true. Since in creatures, no one thing are many things and each of them.
Mm-hmm. Yes. That's called having your cake and eating it, I think. But anyway.
Exactly. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And that's what that Kant likes to do. And actually, that's what Aristotle likes to do. But, you know, that's another story. We can't get into that. But in any case, I mean, just to sum up, because, I mean, there's so much here and it is a bit unwieldy. I did know that before I started. And in a way, I wish I could have got through much more, but I think I'll just end on this point here, if you'll allow me, which is that...
Nietzsche, gosh.
Yeah, there's Nietzsche, didn't get to him.
That must be an early Nietzsche, I don't recognize him at all. Yeah, that's very early, yeah.
Yeah, young Nietzsche.
Yeah, his famous handle with moustache, which was very prominent in later years.
It was, yeah, and he looks...
almost human.
Yeah, almost human there, and much nicer. In any case, I mean, just to sum up, we've broached a lot of different very, very fundamental historical and philosophical questions and problems here. The last thing I'd like to say is just that the assumption so widespread today in Islamic and Western countries alike and throughout the entire world is that non-empirical discourse is fundamentally subjective. That is, anything which is not the so-called hard sciences, you might have better or worse persuasive arguments, but at the end of four things which are, you know, four philosophical questions, four theological opinions, but at the end of the day, ultimately, they are no more than subjective, and it's nothing more than you being convinced. And so it's really a psychological property. You know, it's, you know, I like this, it makes sense to me, so I'm going to be whatever religion it happens to be. I'm going to believe whatever philosophy it happens to be about the world, about ethics and so on. But the modern view, which is now universalized effectively, is that objective knowledge of such things is not even in principle possible. And so that's where this notion of freedom comes in, understood in this what I call arbitrarist sense, which is that it's not freedom in some traditional model of self-mastery or taking one's place in the whole or fulfilling one's true nature, but it's this idea that Brad Gregory, whose beautiful book I thoroughly recommend to everyone, The Unintended Reformation, he says the supreme value in modern science is freedom of choice per se, regardless of what is chosen. And the really important part of that is the regardless of what is chosen part. If you start to tell someone else what they can choose, and indeed the criterion that they're allowed to have for preferring one thing over another, you are simply oppressing them by imposing your own pseudo-authority upon them, which is completely unjustified. And again, it all comes back to the idea, non-empirical discourse, including ethical valuations, including metaphysical valuations, what things really are, essences, is all subjective. And so the only legitimate response to that is this notion of radical freedom, you know, of the individual, and all we really have genuine true access to is our individual wills, and no one can play with that. You know, that's completely up to us, and everything in that domain is completely up to us. That is a profoundly idiosyncratically Western philosophy, which presupposes this very idiosyncratically Western history. And, you know, the sad thing is that so many people who want to do the right thing, let's say people who, you know, in post-colonialism today, for example, that field of study, which you know, wants to decolonize curriculums and things. But I mean, the not very funny irony of that is their philosophy is the most idiosyncratically Western philosophy in the universe, because it is the philosophy of modernism.
This whole trajectory of this thought that's becoming universal, it seems to me, that leads to the inevitable suicide of a civilization. It's unsustainable because you cannot build a civilization on such an outlook, on such a philosophy, because it is without foundations. It has no moral, epistemological, let alone metaphysical or ontological foundations, and therefore it collapses if nothing is solid. And also, it's the contradictions you mentioned. You know, if you were to feel you become a woman and so on. Well, we still do have science which talks about DNA in every human cell, and the DNA just comes in male and female. You know, that's not gone away. It doesn't evaporate because we elevate the will over everything else. Science is still telling us that, in fact, there are such things as males and females in the hardwiring of our biology, in our genetics. That's not gone away. In fact, that's a new discovery since Watson and Crick, of course, DNA. So these both the paradoxes and also the suicidal nature or the self-destructive nature of our civilization. But what's particularly toxic for me, is intrinsically toxic, but is the way it's exported globally as a new kind of liberation or a call to freedom is promoted by governments in Britain and America, that, you know, and the way it condescendingly preaches at Muslims and others, just expecting them to change their religions to conform to this latest. It's a particularly odious and many it seems like yet another instantiation of a colonial mindset that just used to be Christian missionary, used to be liberal, now it's this. We're insisting, the white West insists that the rest of the world jolly well ought to come in line quickly, or it will suffer economic and cultural penalties. It comes at a price. Resistance comes at a price. So
absolutely, and as you said, I mean, that, you know, a very clear manifestation of this is going on right now is the Qatar World Cup. I mean, this extraordinary what they now call virtue signaling. I mean, the German team, which I think is why they went out so early, to be honest. But,
doing other things than football, apparently. They were.
Busy
virtue signaling, yes.
Yeah, I mean, just extraordinary. So, I mean, final thing, in Islam, non-empirical discourse there is a science for it. It's a science of objective and real knowledge. Those abstract entities, we were wondering what on earth do they correspond to. In the Islamic tradition, specifically here, you see the scheme of the Akbarian hierarchy of being. And you know, of course, the Akbari school, although controversial today, was very, very influential and acknowledged in high places and you know, the highest tabaqa, the highest kind of stratum of the ulama in the Ottoman world, in the Mughal world, were typically yani Akbarianism had its place within the Islamic sciences, And it even had a role of a kind of corrective role to the other Islamic sciences. And there were spiritual qualifications which were necessary. So it wasn't kind of entirely publicly accessible to everyone. But it did absolutely have its place, to the extent that someone like Sheikh al-Islam Ibn Kamal Pasha Zadeh, the very famous Ottoman, highest authority in the Ottoman world, the Sheikh al-Islam, has his famous fatwa defending Ibn Arabi and affirming his unquestionable and extremely important place in the Islamic sciences. But in the Akbarian tradition and the Platonic tradition broadly, in Avicennan, certain interpretations of Avicennan philosophy, those abstract propositions which troubled Kant so much, and those abstract principles which don't seem to correspond to anything, but nonetheless our knowledge of the world depends upon them, they do correspond in that correspondence theory, but they correspond to intelligible reality. So their understanding is not that kind of abstractive Aristotelian understanding that what is fundamentally real are physical substances, and we kind of abstract all of the intelligible properties from them. But what's really real is the individual substance. But rather, their understanding is that what's really real is actually the ghaib, the unseen world, what the Platonists would call the intelligible world, and it really is real. And it's the dwelling place of the angels, and it's the dwelling place of spirits, and it's the dwelling place of, in some sense, forms. However, forms.
The Quran itself and the Hadith allude to this. So, when you die, you will realize that this world was, comparatively speaking, not the real world. The real world is the unseen, and that's when we will really understand the truth and realities of things. So, there's a sense that this is a lesser order of affairs. That's clearly in the Quran and the Hadith, of course.
Absolutely, and so their understanding of the world was so integrated with their revealed understanding of the world was so integrated with their rational understanding, their philosophies in these higher traditions, that these questions of what is objective reality, how do we account for the problem of abstract truth, which doesn't seem to correspond to the world that we can experience, was explicitly dealt with in terms of this scheme of the hierarchy of being. So to take just one example, our concept of unity, for example, which is especially in the Platonic tradition so important, and the problem of the one and the many, and the one over the many, which is the form, and that's why Plato posited there has to be a form, because there has to be a one over the many. Let's say, why do we look out on the world, see lots of what are really just individuals, but say, oh no, those are all humans, those ones are humans, and those ones are trees? Well, none of the individuals are human nature itself. So, none of the individuals, nor the individuals taken together, can account for why there is this human nature there in the first place. So for Plato, there has to be something prior which answers to human nature. To take the idea of the one, in this tradition, so how do we account for this non-empirical concept, the one? It's no empirical property, and yet we can't know the world without it. Well, they'd say the one unfolds in different spheres of existence. It starts off with God's unity, and that's where it originally comes from. And it is this, and individuality as well, al-huwiyya. So, in the medieval world, what was known as haicity. So the individual identity, what is that? It's not empirical property. For them, it's ultimately a reflection. It's a shadow or a reflection of what is ultimately God's identity, which is this, and God's unity. And so these properties unfold through various degrees of being until they appear in our world. And yes, our world, there's no such thing as the purely physical world. It's always imbued with the intelligible, with the nonsensible, with the metaphysical, even in our ordinary experience. And I think the amazing thing is Kant actually realized that, But the only way he could grapple with this huge difficulty of how is it that sensible properties interact with non-sensible properties to produce knowledge, when non-sensible properties don't seem to be part of the fabric of reality. Therefore, you know, his only way of dealing with that is to say, well, it must all be imposed. Everything's subjective. Mm-hmm. Whereas this had a way of, this tradition had a way, not just the Akbarian tradition. I mean, it's all detailed in my book, Nafsul Amr, but things as they are, but not just the Akbarian tradition by any means, but I think in a way it's par excellence the tradition which was able to deal with this in a really holistic manner. But in our tradition, there's a way for, in some sense, situating subjectivity within objectivity so that the subjective becomes an integral part of being and objective reality. Mm. So, I mean, as you can see, there are a lot of complex things involved. I think we've had enough for one day. So I'll stop there. But thank you very much for bearing with me.
No, not at all. It's fantastic. You mentioned your book, Things As They Are, but there's the Metacritic of Kant and the Possibility of Metaphysics and Hierarchy of Freedom. Are these two books about to be published this year? Or
the Metaphysics of the Possibility of Metaphysics is already out.
Oh,
good to finally see you. Sorry, I've just been staring at my presentation the entire time. I couldn't see you. The Possibility of Metaphysics is already out. The Hierarchy is in press. So it's any day now. Probably in the next couple of weeks, it will appear on Amazon.
Certainly get hold of those two. Well, thank you very much indeed, Hassan, for your erudition, eloquence, and your patience in explaining all this. I know a number of your students at Desai Chuna College are anxiously waiting to hear you this evening. So thank you very much, and I will certainly get these new works that you've just written. Have a read of those. So inshallah, maybe another time we can discuss those works as well.
I'd be delighted. I mean, if you still want to talk to me after all that.
Of course. No, I'm unfortunately, you've just whetted my appetite for more, unfortunately.
So, alhamdulillah. Alhamdulillah.
This is blogging theology after all. This is what we do. It's also interesting that, it's a slightly silly point, but we're both Englishmen in England, converts to Islam, and wearing suspiciously similar pattern shirts as well. This is all very worrying.
It's extraordinary. Amazing ittifaq, but alhamdulillah, God works in mysterious ways.
Indeed he does. Oh, well, thank you very much, Hassan, and good evening to you, and until next time, thank you.
Thank you very much. Take care.